The trial of Norwegian mass murderer Anders Behring Breivik is getting global media attention, and not just for his crimes, but for the decision to broadcast the trial live and allow journalists to tweet the proceedings. So is this a global platform for Breivik's hate crimes, or a statement of open government and journalism, Norwegian style? Here's a clip from Sky News from the opening of the trial.
This was not a man ready to say sorry. Smiling, apparently at ease in the court built to hear his case. Anders Behring Breivik's handcuffs were removed. He gave his trademark salute, which he believes signifies the strength of his cause. Then a startling sight as Breivik shook the hands of the judges who'll decide whether he'll be jailed or treated.
I'm joined now by Dr. Gavin Titley of NUI Maynooth, author of The Crisis of Multiculturalism and someone who knows Norway very well. Gavin, let's look at the issues here. Right, this man is a ruthless killer. He is either insane or he is deeply evil. Isn't it dangerous and even irresponsible to give him this huge platform?
I think it's a very complex one because obviously it's not just a question of public interest in Norway. It's a trauma for Norwegian society, and therefore the decision to televise as much as possible of the trial with some restrictions around Breivik's testimony, for example, showing any of the footage from the attacks themselves and some of the survivor statements. None of that will be broadcast, but a lot of the trial will be broadcast, and that's been kind of subject to quite a debate in Norway over the last while. One of the reasons for it is, well, there's a number of reasons, but one of the reasons for it is that Breivik himself, in his manifesto, saw the trial as a potential propagandistic phase. He talked about any potential judicial process that he'd be involved in as a way in which he could explain his act, explain the political logic, and that he could also reject the authority of the Norwegian state because, as he sees it, having accepted what he calls multiculturalism, it is no longer a valid state and it has no jurisdiction over him anymore. So there's quite a lot of worry that his ideas will, that he'll be given a political platform of a certain kind. Also, of course, if you look at his political logic, one of the things that we see in kind of political violence, if you like, terroristic violence, is a dependence on media spectacle. So for everything from Al-Qaeda's videos of beheadings, the political act of violence is also bound up with the media logic. How are we going to get this out there in the world? Which is, of course, the exact opposite of the logic of, you know, armies of occupation who want to hide away the violence that they're responsible for. So the media logic of coverage is very central to Breivik's own logic, which means that I think it's very difficult for journalists, because of course it's not just anymore a Norwegian issue or a question of Norwegian public interest, it's one of global interest. And there's over 800 journalists from around the world who are covering this trial. There's several live blogs, there's constant live stream on 24-hour news stations around the world. And what that has brought with it is a range of different discussions about the media ethics of covering his statements, secondhand, of course, not live from him in the courtroom. But also, I think, a lot of questions about the framing of his politics, the framing of questions of sanity, the framings of the legitimations that he gives for his actions, and also ways of which Norway has been represented in the media coverage.
But Gavin, what options do the media have when there is such interest in a case like this?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think one of the starting points for a lot of the coverage is that people accept the idea that because he's interested in a propagandistic platform, that to not report the issues would be to run the risk of, if you like, censoring the issues, adding to the kind of attractiveness of them potentially for listeners or for others who are politically think like him around Europe at the moment. And therefore, there's been a kind of consensus that you can't turn him into a martyr by not reporting his views. Of course, on the other hand, there's a lot of sensationalism around this trial. Anything to do with the far right, quite apart from the sheer horror of the crime, but anything to do with the far right is always very interesting because it has that sense of the occult, it has that sense of extreme political logic around it, and also there's the whole question bound up in it as to whether he is regarded as being sane and competent for his actions or not. So it's also a trial which, of course, has a kind of a narrative to it. He's represented as an individual, and in many ways he's trying to kind of humanise himself in talking about his background. He's being also asked about his background, his upbringing, his education, his motives. So there's a certain kind of difficulty in reporting that when you want to keep the framework on the crime itself. And I think it's worth recalling what the logic of that crime was, because very often this is reported in relation to his beliefs, which is, for example, his attacks on multiculturalism. But he killed, I mean, it was a political assassination. He murdered young social democrats because he saw them as traitors. He saw them as the ones that were facilitating the erosion of cultural purity and of the nation in Norway. So it was a political assassination on a par with, for example, the killings of freedom riders in civil rights era USA, anti-apartheid activists and so forth. It was a political assassination. And he's been standing up every day to make clear that he saw it as a political assassination. Now, this presents some kinds of problems, I think, for reporters, particularly when they approach political acts in ways that attempt to be dispassionate and attempt to report the trial as a process, attempt to report politics without putting particular kinds of labels on it. But there is only one label which is available for Breivik's actions, and that is that it's a fascist act. He was attempting to purify the nation. But I think a lot of coverage has drawn back from talking about it in terms of fascism because it's regarded as such a loaded label, whereas in fact it's politically it's a very accurate label for thinking about what those acts were and proceeding on that basis.
But just because he's categorised it as a political act, do the media then have to accept that and report it as though he is expounding some sort of valid views?
Well, I don't think to recognise the political nature of the act is not the same as recognising the validity of the act. What's important about recognising the political nature of the act, and this has been something which has been argued quite a lot in Norway, for example, by many of the victims' families who challenged the first psychiatric assessment of him because they wanted him to be tried for criminal liability. And quite many commentators on the trial as well have made the point that there's a difference between, on the one hand, recognising the political nature of this, because that's also got to do with respecting the victims. The victims were at a political meeting. They were targeted for their beliefs. And therefore, it isn't all just about what Breivik says. It's also to dilute their deaths into questions just of psychology would be, at some level, quite disrespectful, I would say. On the other hand, what Breivik talks about and how he justifies those acts and how he frames his reasoning for targeting young social democrats, that doesn't need to be accepted. It needs to be explored. And I think it needs to be explored far more than it is being explored, because in a way two things are happening in some of the coverage that I've been looking at. On the one hand, Breivik is regarded as an extremist, which of course he is. His actions are extreme. But the problem about that is that while there's a lot of people in Europe, there's a lot of journalists, there's a lot of bloggers, there's a lot of politicians who have condemned the murders, they haven't repudiated his thinking. And we've had at least 10 years of very, very mainstream figures in Europe speaking in more or less the same kind of terms as Breivik, talking about Muslim invasion, talking about cultural war, talking about the need to protect our cultures before it's too late. And when you have that kind of very violent, very excitable discussion of war and invasion and the problem of Muslims in Europe, it's one thing to suggest that other people who've spoken like this and who have conducted these kinds of discussions for well over 10 years, of course they're not liable for Breivik's actions, but there are questions to be asked about the kind of political climate which has been created, and to recognise the fact that quite a lot of people across Europe think like Breivik or would use similar kinds of ideas like Breivik. You only have to read, for example, the comment threads on almost any article on immigration, for example, be it on The Guardian Comment is Free or be it on any such site, to see that that kind of thinking is quite widespread. So it's important to explore it. It's important to take it apart factually. But I think it's important also to put it in the context of a particular kind of violent right-wing extremist violence.
Now, obviously, the concern is that by giving him a platform, you will perpetuate these views. But is there any possibility that because he's clearly a sociopath, he's clearly, you know, insane, well, arguably insane, that this will rebound against that viewpoint?
This has been a debate, particularly in Norway and elsewhere. I know that Asa Sirsgaard, for example, who was the author of The Bookkeeper of Kabul, but she was wondering whether this was turning into a circus which would in many ways be difficult to control. As opposed to that, another big Norwegian intellectual, Thomas Hulund Eriksen, who's written quite a bit on the trial, was making the point that exposure to these ideas and their banality and their, if you like, their extremist nature and the sheer hatred which informs them over a long period of time would act as what he calls a mosquito repellent, that ultimately people would see that they don't want to be, that they might hold certain prejudices, but they certainly don't want to be associated with this. But I think it does come back to this question of the nature of the psychiatric assessment and the battle which is currently ongoing around the psychiatric assessment, and then how we think about that in not just in psychiatric terms, but in media terms and political terms. Right back at the beginning of August, So a couple of weeks after the events themselves, a team of psychiatrists in Norway were essentially started to interview Breivik, and they interviewed him for 35, 36 hours over August and came back with a diagnosis of what they saw as paranoid schizophrenia. And one of the reasons they were giving for this was they were saying that he kept insisting that he felt personally as if he was about to come under attack. So in other words, they were making the point that while he was advocating a particular kind of extremist ideological position, he was also translating translating that into a kind of very paranoid sense of self-preservation. But that has been challenged successfully by a subsequent team of psychiatrists who have overturned the first psychological assessment. And one of the reasons given for that, of course, is that we have a manifesto, and that manifesto is something which has been put together painstakingly over time to justify and to explain the political act and everything that he sees lying underneath it, which is ultimately, as he sees it, the betrayal of European by multicultural European elites. So there's another argument which says, well, he might have some particular kind of psychiatric condition, and I'm in no position to make a judgment call on that. Obviously, there's clinical questions here. But on the other hand, at the level, again, returning to think about this politically, in some ways it doesn't really matter. It matters judicially whether he is regarded as being competent for his actions or not. And that's something which apparently, in terms of many of the victims' families, they feel very strongly about the fact that he's found criminally responsible and guilty for what he did. But in terms of thinking about this, in terms of reporting it, there's a distinction, I think, between, on the one hand, whether he is found judicially to be clinically insane or incapable of taking full responsibility for his actions, and the fact that, nevertheless, he articulated a very complete paranoid ideological picture of what's happening in Europe. And as I said, one that is widely held and widely spread, and one that he put together in his own manifesto by quoting what The Guardian called, when they did a data map of the people who are cited in his manifesto, they called it his spider web of hate. And it's quite interesting to see how far that spider web extends. So I think we have to be careful about assuming that even if he were to be regarded as being criminally insane, that doesn't mean that what he did can be regarded simply as the work of a lunatic. It has to be kept in political context as to what's happening in Europe at the moment.
Now, I know that some of the reporters who had been tweeting from the trial decided to censor their own tweets because they said taking a line of his out of context, which is all you can do on Twitter, was giving it a validity that it didn't deserve. What do you think of that? I mean, what sort of dialogue is there in Norway at the moment about the way this trial is being covered?
I've seen people argue that on Twitter, and I think they're absolutely correct, because of course the nature of Twitter is that it does take things out of context. If it isn't a thought which can simply be shaped into the characters available, then it is something which is being taken out of context. And of course it runs the risk then of taking some of his thoughts and turning them into slogans, turning them, if you like, into rallying cries. And I think a lot of the journalists have shown the kind of, I suppose, ongoing reflection that's needed from journalists when they now find themselves in situations which a few years previously they would have simply covered by writing things into a notebook and filing. Now they're expected to be covering both for their deadline but also tweeting at the same time some kind of live coverage. So I think it's very heartening to see that kind of reflection from journalists. I think other dimensions of the coverage certainly have become quite controversial in Norway from what I've read of the coverage there secondhand, which is in particular, and you had it in the clip there, the Sky News anchor who was talking about the shocking sight of him shaking hands, for example, in the court. And there's been a lot of coverage, there's been a lot of opinion pieces written about the fact that almost Norwegian society and Norwegian judicial process seems to be too soft. So, for example, the fact that unless he is categorised as a danger to society, then he will only be liable to spend 21 years in jail. So there's been, I think, a very distasteful dimension to some of the coverage, which I'd stop short of saying that it suggests that Norway deserved what it got, but there's a sense of saying, well, look at this extremist you have, look at what he did, and yet this is all you're prepared to do to him. This is the only kind of punishment that you're prepared to actually implement. This is the respect that you treat him with in court. Why isn't he behind a cage? Why isn't he liable for life with the key being thrown away? And I think there's been a reaction against that in Norway, particularly people recalling it to Jens Stoltenberg, the Prime Minister's statements in the immediate aftermath of the massacre, which said that the answer to an assault on democracy is more democracy. And there's been a very strong counter argument from some Norwegian journalists to say, look, this is actually about democracy as a process. This is actually about putting those values which were attacked on display by not, if you like, corroding the quality of our democracy in the way in which we treat this particular criminal. And I think what that points to, of course, is because as the Breivik trial goes on, different journalists, different commentators are reporting on what's going on in Norway, but the coverage also becomes bound up in issues which exist for their home readerships and their home audiences. So certainly when it comes to, for example, questions of law and order, when this is reported in the US media, and particularly with the punitive approach that we associate with US society, that's become one issue which has been debated there, for example, also to some extent in Britain.
Okay, Gavin, listen, thanks very much for that. That was Gavin Titley there.